Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is former Congresswoman Anne Marie Burkle. She has just finished up her term of service as the representative for New York's 25th District, which has now become the 24th. This past November, she was defeated in her reelection bid by Dan Maffei, the incumbent whom she beat in 2010. Congresswoman Burkle, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Well, your session of Congress was very busy in its last days with the negotiations to avoid the fiscal cliff, and I did want to ask you about that. But really, this conversation is intended to be a look back at your 2 years of service, and that's what I'm going to focus on the most. But on the fiscal cliff deal, which you voted against along with the majority of your Republican colleagues in the House, you said you voted against it because it didn't address the deficit and government spending. And the bill delayed the sequestration spending cuts by only 2 months. So that Congress is going to be at that issue again pretty soon. I wanted to get your prediction of what you think is going to happen on that issue in the next 2 months. Will there just be another extension to further delay the automatic cuts, or is something more substantial going to happen?
I'm concerned that there will be a delay and we'll just continue to kick the can down the road. And that concerns me. It certainly is not the right way to go for this nation. If something was going to be done, it should have been done. You know, we sent a bill over to the Senate in August to extend all of the current tax rates, to do a reconciliation bill for sequestration, to not delay those cuts, but to spread those costs over the entire government rather than focusing on DOD. And so the Senate didn't take them up the way they waited until the very, very last hour to take it up and send this bill back is unfortunate. And I'm hopeful that it will be different in this next Congress, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to follow up on was, and it's, I guess, a more general version of the question I started with, is there has been some writing to the effect that this particular experience of cutting a deal on the fiscal cliff will harbor in a new era of Congress and the president working differently together, because you did have this situation where the bill came before the House. A majority of the majority party's members in the House voted against it, but it still passed, and so that was allowed to happen and so on. Do you see evidence of perhaps there's been a corner that's been turned here?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. The president continues to say we need to have a balanced approach. We increase revenues, but we also decrease cut spending. And we didn't see that. This H.R. 8 that you're speaking of, avoiding the fiscal cliff, had no cuts in it. In fact, it added $4 trillion to the debt over 10 years. And so unless the president is willing to meet Congress halfway and compromise, I still am perplexed at why no one will go with the Simpson-Bowles recommendations. And with the budget that we passed, there were 31 of us in the House, some Democrats, some Republicans, who voted for that. It's called the La Tourette budget, but it was a Simpson-Bowles recommendation. That's the bipartisan, that's the president's ideas. And gosh, that seems to me like a very fair and a good place to start.
Well, let's look back at your term of service now. And I want to start, I guess, with the most recent part of it, the campaign and the election last November. You've said recently in the Post Standard that your only regret was that you lost. But it seems to me any loss prompts the questions of what might have been done differently to produce a different outcome. So let me start with that. Is there something that you think you could have done differently, or that you could have better anticipated, that might have helped change the outcome in retrospect?
I could have been running in South Carolina. No, you know, this is a presidential year, and the numbers and the turnout and all of the factors are very different. And I said it in my interview with the Post Standard, and I'll say it again. I was defeated by Barack Obama. He had a ground game in upstate New York. He had a ground game throughout the country to that level where he had people in Syracuse doing door-to-door. And that was very difficult to offset. We were able to get in Onondaga County, there were 40,000 additional votes in 2012 compared to 2010, and that was the president. Of those 40,000 that went for Barack Obama, we were able to get 20,000 of those votes. So 20,000 voters in the city went for Obama and Burkle. And that, to me, we did make a lot of inroads in the city. We did what a lot of Republicans don't do. We went into our non-traditional communities, and we worked with them and helped share a vision for this country. And it worked. But in a presidential year in a state as blue as New York, that's just one of the risks that we had to face.
Well, here's one possibility that struck me anyway, looking back on it. And I wanted to run it by you, see what you think about this. And that taps into something that's been a longstanding interest of mine in terms of how campaigns are run and particularly the ads are done. You also said in the paper that you were unfairly labeled as extreme. And this race ended up costing $10 million in total. And the result of that on the ground for the voter during the months leading up to the election, I think, was an endless repetition of the standard 30-second ads that were mostly negative back and forth between you and Dan Maffei. So for all that money, the standard campaign didn't change. We just got a lot more of it. And I think everybody became pretty numb at some point. So I was wondering what your thoughts were about this. If you had been able to anticipate right from the start the degree of that expense and the total immersion that it was going to generate, I wonder if it would have been better for your message to have decided to have somewhat fewer ads, to make them longer, to make them more substantive, to really talk about the issues in more detail than you ever could in 30 seconds or maybe even 60 seconds in order to kind of counteract that impression that you think was unfairly put on you.
That's a great point. I think, as you mentioned, midway through this election cycle, which, as we know, started just months and months and months before November the 8th, the voters were just hammered with information. And I think whether it was 30 seconds or 60 seconds that they would have tuned it out. But I personally made a decision early on in the campaign that my ads, the ones that I had control over, were about my vision, my family, my roots in upstate New York, my stand on the issues, and what distinguished me from my opponent. And because I said to the folks who were running it, who are in Virginia and across the country, I have to live here and I know people here and I want my message out. But as you mentioned, we were hammered. And that was not just in our campaign. That was a strategy that the progressives and the Democrats had throughout the country to label anyone who didn't agree with them as an extremist and to marginalize them. And that was there were several female members in the House who were targeted, and Mary Bono Mack from California, Judy Biggert from Illinois, Nan Hayworth from downstate. We were all defeated, and we all withstood the same hammering about being extreme. And interestingly enough, some of those women, in fact, all three of them, are not as conservative as I on the social issues.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with former Congresswoman Anne Marie Burkle. She represented New York's 25th district. You've said before and on many occasions that being accessible to the voters and providing constituents with responsible service were the top priorities for you. I wanted to ask you a question about the Washington piece of this, though. I'm curious to know what you view to be your most significant accomplishments in Washington inside Congress in your 2 years.
Well, certainly the legislation that I was able to get passed, I had a sexual assault bill that was in a veterans bill that was passed into law, signed into law by the president. I had a bill, the TSP bill, which holds federal employees to the same standard as a civilian employee with regards to garnishment if they owe the federal government money. I was able to get a post office named for a young man in Baldwinsville who was killed in the line of duty in Afghanistan. So those legislative accomplishments were very important to me. We dropped several bills. Unfortunately, it was difficult to get them out of committees, but the autoimmune awareness bill was a very big piece, very important. So many Americans are affected with that disease. But, I was able to give the weekly address. I was the presidential appointment as the Republican congressional rep to the UN. I just had so many wonderful opportunities, and I just am proud of, and you mentioned the word regret. I don't regret. I only regret losing, but I am so proud of both campaigns and both the 2 years of service.
And in Washington, one of the other things you did invest a lot of your time and attention on was the government's botched attempt to track weapons at the Mexican border, known as Operation Fast and Furious. Why did you make that particular issue such a priority?
Well, I really didn't. The Post Standard did. That was Darrell Issa was chairman of Oversight and Government Reform. He was going to take that issue on. And so we had several hearings with regards to, in fact, the Border Patrol agent, his family was in, his mom, his sister, his cousin. And we conducted several interviews with the Department of Justice and Eric Holder. My comment to the Post Standard was, aside from the usual phone calls and constituent issues that we deal with, this is the one, it's sort of a grassroots, people would call the office up and say, make sure you hold the Department of Justice accountable. A young man's life was lost. And that was, of course, not translated that way in the paper. But I think for many people, that issue represented accountability and this issue of accountability and why the government, whether it's the Department of Justice or any other agency, why they don't feel like they have to explain and shed light on, whatever they're doing, good or bad. And in this case, a young man's life was lost.
I know that across the nation, generally, the gun rights community put a lot of attention on criticism of Operation Fast and Furious. Do you think that that was driving some of the voter and constituent messages that you were getting here in the district too?
Well, I think that was part of it. And you're right, the Second Amendment, the folks who are very pro-Second Amendment were paying close attention to this. But I think it goes to a bigger issue, this lack of accountability. And we've seen it again with Benghazi and what happened there and forthcomingness from the administration and from these cabinet. You know, this in Benghazi, it's Secretary of State, Department of Justice, and Eric Holder with Fast and Furious. You know, the American people deserve answers. And maybe mistakes were made, but that's, you know, in something as broad as the scope of this government and all the things, mistakes are going to happen. But an honesty and a forthrightness, I think, is what the American people are demanding.
Is there one particular member of Congress that you encountered who you would hold up as a model to be admired and emulated?
There were several. There actually were several members. When I first went into Congress and was sworn in, I became close with a woman by the name of Diane Black from Tennessee, a registered nurse. There were actually a small group of nurses that got elected this past in 2010. But there are many members. Jim Jordan from Ohio, Jason Chaffetz from Utah, James Langford from Oklahoma, just really, I think Congress, for the most part, there are people there who really are deeply committed to this country and want to do a good job for their district and want to do a good job for the country. Unfortunately, I think there's a certain amount of dysfunction in Washington, the status quo, go along to get along rather than, you know, doing what's right and what's best for this country and being more concerned about your reelection rather than what's best for this country.
Well, you mentioned this perception that people have and your view that most members are there trying to do the right thing. But still, Congress has this horribly low rating. Is there one thing about Congress as an institution specifically that most people don't know that if they did know, they'd feel a little better about the place?
I think so. I think that a lot gets done in Washington. A lot of ideas are fleshed out. A lot of thoughts about what the best way to go for the nation is. And unfortunately, the media plays into this. Nothing's getting done. There's complete dysfunction, and there's so much rancor between the Republican House and the Democratic Senate. I don't think that's necessarily as bad as it's been portrayed in the media. A lot of things get done. There's a lot of bipartisan efforts. Simpson-Bowles' budget was a perfect example. I worked with Carolyn Maloney from downstate liberal Democrat on human trafficking issues. So many of the efforts that we took, even like with oversight and Fast and Furious, a lot of those members want to do what's right, who may not be so pro-Second Amendment but still want accountability and openness and, with regards to the government and how they relate to the American people.
So to put another spin on this, there's report just out looking at the last Congress, the Congress you were in, and by sort of the traditional measurements of activity, it did the least of recent Congresses. So what you're saying is if we could get sort of below the numbers, we'd see more activity and see things happening?
I think you got to look below the numbers, but you also have to – when you say Congress, the American people think the House of Representatives – we can only do so much. We passed hundreds of bills out of the House, and they went over to the Senate, and there they just died a very slow, painful death. The budget was one of those. We passed over 30 jobs bills to get this economy moving, to get the American people back to work. That went over to the Senate. They didn't take up any of those bills. So a lot of dysfunction is you can't negotiate with yourself. If the Senate doesn't act, we're just, you know, it isn't like we haven't done it. It's just it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, thinking about the House of Representatives, if there was – if you could change one thing about it to make it work better, what would it be?
I think the American people and should really think, and because it would be a constitutional amendment, about term limits, about lengthening the term of Congress in the House and then, you know, having term limits. Because what I noticed down there is that there is just more of the same. And people protect their little fiefdoms, and they go along to get along, and they buy into leadership so that they can get a committee assignment. But if you've got term limits, you're more concerned with your election, with your doing what's right for the country rather than your election, because you know you've only got two terms. And I think it's something that we really should think about. And some would say, well, term limits come in the form of elections every year. But I think a longer term – and then making it – terming, you know, having – say it was a 4-year term, having a possibly a 3-term limit or something. But there's just people who have been down there who have made it a way of life. And I don't think the House of Representatives was ever meant to be that way.
The piece of that that a lot of political scientists have focused in on is the length of term aspect of it more than the term limits. And the problem that they've identified is that you folks are constantly running. So how quickly were you running for re-election after you were elected in 2010? Was it the next day or was it the day before?
No, I wasn't politically savvy enough. I waited about a year to get serious about fundraising and considering the next election. There's a huge learning curve when you get down to Washington and your district office to make sure they run well, make sure they – you know, my primary goal was, okay, what's our mission? And our mission was constituent service, as you mentioned. And I think that's – so we did a lot of that for the first year. And then when I felt comfortable that I had gotten settled in, then we began to look at the campaign.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm speaking with former Congresswoman Anne Marie Burkle. There's one question that I have to ask based on the ads that went back and forth during the campaign. And this one regards some of the ads that were run against Dan Maffei. Have you given your staff any salary bonuses at the end?
We did not. In fact, we cut our budget, all of the House did, in 2011 by 5%, in 2012 by 6%, and in 2011 we gave back $120,000 to the government, and this year we will be on – we're on target to return that same amount to the taxpayers. That's not our money. That is the taxpayers' money, and we need to be good stewards of that money.
And looking to the future, you said recently in the Post-Standard piece that you're considering challenging Dan Maffei in 2014. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. You know, it certainly is one of the options on the table. As you mentioned, we stayed busy right up until the very end. And I really haven't had a chance to digest the election and a way forward. Right now I have a 91-year-old mother in Auburn who needs a visit from me and reacquaint myself with her and my kids and my grandkids. But it certainly is one of the options on the table, and I look forward to doing that analysis.
And could you say a little bit more about how you're going to make the decision? I know that you can't say now what the decision will be, but how will you go about figuring that out when you do get the time to think about it?
Well, I think you have to look at redistricting. Those numbers, those registered Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and independents, and then look at the voter turnout and look to see who showed up in 2010 versus who showed up in 2012. And even if you can win the race in 2014, what happens in the next presidential year? You know, you have to be realistic in New York State. If you are a Republican conservative, as you've seen from the statewide elections, it's difficult to be elected. I think the job we did when I held the seat and the constituent service and all the outreach we did to the community goes a long way in overcoming some of those odds. But those would be the kinds of things we would consider.
And have you contacted any potential donors yet, or have they contacted you?
Oh, since the election the end of the election, you know, hundreds of people have approached me about running again, about staying in the fight. But it's far too premature to make that decision.
So you're not dialing for dollars at this point, is it?
No, sir.
Well, you mentioned something just a second ago, and this is the thing I really wanted to get into with you about thinking about the future. If you look at this district and you think about its political history and you look at the demographics and you think about how it votes more generally, one could make the argument that a Republican candidate with a clear branding as a moderate would be the kind of candidate that would do quite well against Dan Maffei when he's running for re-election, like a Richard Hanna type or a Joni Mahoney type, for example. So do you think that you will always be something of a complicated fit for a district like this?
You know, I look at the support that I had in this past election and in the initial election, but certainly in this one. We generated an excitement and a base of support not seen in upstate New York. You know, we coalesced the Republican conservative movement and really was able to accomplish and put together an organization I don't think ever seen in the excitement and the support. So, no, and it's interesting because when you're out in the community and when we – what I hear from the constituents, what I heard from them, emails, letters, town halls, teletown halls – the American people and the people in upstate New York are concerned about this, what's happening to this nation and this staggering debt and this unwillingness to take on the debt and to put a plan in place. They're concerned about jobs and the economy. They're concerned about the regulatory burdens and the tax burdens that are put on people and put on businesses. And so I don't think my positions are all that extreme or all that conservative for the American people and for the people who live upstate New York. That was the message in the last campaign, but I don't think it necessarily is accurate.
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end, and I guess it's going to be just one question because you answered the three questions just a couple months ago when you were a candidate, so we won't repeat them here. But I did want to ask you this one thing instead as a way to end our conversation. Let's say that you're sending a card to your former constituents. Let's say it's this verbal card right now. What's the closing line that you would put on that before you sign your name?
In sincere appreciation. I just have been so fortunate and I so appreciate and I'm so grateful for this opportunity to serve upstate New York, to be the first female member of Congress from the 25th, now the 24th district. And I just so appreciate the opportunity that was given to me by the people who live here.
That was former Congresswoman Anne Marie Birkel. Congresswoman Birkel, thanks so much for talking with me.
Always a pleasure, Grant. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest.